that's where the final's going to be. It's going to be in here. You can write it here for 3 hours after you properly prepare. I'm going to tell you the subject. I've got to formulate a question so it'll pin you down. And at the end of the hour, it'll be clear. It may be clearer what the question will be. All the stuff we have would help you in this particular problem or paper. This is definitely on the subject. This is definitely on the subject. And all that we've read so far from 3rd Nephi, 4th Nephi, Mormon, now it's Ether, then it would be Moroni, those five books. There's a central theme runs all through them. Yesterday I had a long conversation with Brother Oakes. He gave that excellent talk during conference on War and Peace. But I say he underplayed the Book of Mormon. That is the greatest a thesis on War and Peace, the greatest epic on the subject we have. That's the whole theme. So that's what the subject is going to be for the paper we're going to write now, for the final. Now, what would be a good way to formulate it? Let's think at the end of the class how we could make a specific question. Oh, let's send this around again to convict you. But let's turn to Ether now. The word Ether means Athera. Means the one who left a trace, the one who left his mark, or left a record. Atharites, in all Semitic languages, it's the same. And ether, ethera, means to leave a track, to trail somebody. Well, he left his tracks in the sand, but it was the brother of Jared that left most of them. This takes us to a new setting, as we said here once. Imagine having finished first Nephi, the trek through the desert, that marvelous account how they go through the desert. Everything's very accurate in it. I've had large classes of nothing but Arab students at this school in the early days when we had Point Four and President Harris was in charge and we brought half the Near East, came to BYU. And they were required to take Book of Mormon, so the class was with all these Arabs, and boy, did they eat it up. Nephi was their boy. I mean, they knew everything. It was all familiar, it was all correct. But having done that, having made that epic story, what about changing the whole thing entirely, as we say here? Now imagine any man insane enough to try after such colossal exertions to write another such story of equal length and detail. The book of Ether is about the same as First Nephi, you see. But this time about a totally different race of people, living in an age far removed from any other and a wholly different geographical setting. Everything is different in the book of Ether, except the plot. The plot's the same and it works out the same. So what's going on? Why is it the same? Because it's always been the same. We'll see that. Not even Joseph Smith ever called attention to this prodigious feat, what he's done here. The man who wrote the Book of Mormon, yeah, but who wrote the Book of Ether? Well, he couldn't have got any help from those sources. Now, every century, of course, sees its wars, its treaties, and its the troubles and the affairs of men. A man who is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. The same types of troubles, the same types of jealousy, the same types of passion, as the singer says, as Ecclesiastes says, and nothing changes. It's always the same baloney. This world is always that way, but always in a different setting. This is the point. The setting does make a difference, and we're going into a different setting ourselves. That's why the Book of Ether is important, because everything shifts in the world, climatic change and everything else. And so the test of historical document isn't that it tells you of wars and alarms and rumors of wars, but the setting it puts it in. I mean, those casual details that could only be noted by one who was on the scene. It couldn't have been invented by anyone. Only an eyewitness could have them. And the story of Jared is a marvelous example of that. There's nothing original in that. Story of Nephi, of Lehi, leaving Jerusalem and wandering through the desert, the same that of the Jaredites, as far as that goes. But it was also the same in the case of Noah and Enoch and Abraham and Moses and the church in the wilderness, and the Latter-day Saints coming west and so forth. It's the same epic of Das Wandern der Gottesvolk. In fact, Keseman wrote a famous book on that subject, God's Wandering People. They're always chased out into the desert. So this is the same sort of thing. But what strange institutions and practices we find in the Book of Ether. It's all very different. Well, how can we ever be able to check up on such stuff? Well, we can do it. Now, first there's the driving force of the whole thing. Was years ago, well, it was in 1966, I wrote an article for a journal. I had been writing quite a bit on the Asiatic, because on the Asiatic background here of a very early history. And this talks about the migrations at the time, well, that have occurred from time to time. In the present century, in the 1930s, H. Monroe Chadwick, Chadwick's an important name here, for if you're going to study the Book of Enoch, Ether, Chadwick, better get our wits about us here, H. Monroe, and his wife, she worked with him on these things, they pointed out what should have been obvious to everybody all along. There's a type of literature, well, all the great civilizations begin with an epic literature, a type of literature known as epic. It's quite different from all the other. And he pointed out that it couldn't possibly be fake. There are fake epics, like the Aeneid is a good example. The Lusiad is a good example. Ossian is a good example of people trying to fake epics, but you can't fake it. It sticks out all over the place, you see, this heroic poetry. But Chadwick pointed out what should have been obvious to everyone, namely that epic literature, a large and important segment of human history. Why does he bother to bring this in anyway? Yeah, just a different setting. Because this is an enormous chunk of history. This represents at least half of what's been going on in the past. And you can't neglect it. It's the same thing like with the Book of Moses. This takes us back and fits us into the cosmic setting. If this is the gospel, this is the eternal word of God and his dealings with men here, you've got to have more than the Wasatch Church and a provincial Christianity, the way we do. The Christian world is very small compared with the other. You've got to take account of all the others. And so we have this, and as I said, it gives us a very large chunk of history, and it also concerns us. And it's the time that we're coming into today, because you know we're living in one world today. Things are, we know much more about Asia today. We're right next door to them. I mean, my kids go over to China and Central Asia all the time. Son-in-law's now in Budapest, and one son's in Guam. They move around all over the place. And so it's a bigger world we're living in now. And the Book of Ether opens it up in its archaic setting, and it lays down the basic principles of, we'll see, of Asiatic nonsense. So, it was not this literature that's left us by these various people is not the product of an unrestrained poetic fancy. They used to think it was. But it really reflects real years of horror. Since this was written, I say, in 1966, a lot has been done on this, and it shows that the beginnings of civilization everywhere do not slowly emerge from a primitive background, as my professor Wilson used to say at Chicago in Egyptology. It began infinitely, gradually, and painfully. They worked themselves up. For all these species to adapt themselves to their peculiar ways of life, it must have taken millions of generations, because it had to be just hit or miss. You see, it had to be natural selection. And so it went on so slowly. But the fact is, the thing has been interrupted, bang, again and again. Remember, we started out mentioning extermination. There have been great extermination periods, and periods very near extermination, again and again, when, well, this was a thing first pointed out in the 60s at this time by Schindewolf, which he called neocatastrophism. He showed how again and again, all the predominant life forms, nearly all of them, suddenly disappear, and in their place, different ones suddenly emerge. Well, that has to do maybe with meteorites striking the Earth, or great changes, you know, the iridium layer and all that. We won't go into that now. The thing is that these were real years of terror and gloom through which the entire race had been forced to pass from time to time. We now have good reason to believe, after many years of controversy and discussion, scientific and otherwise, that the violence of the elements forms the somber background of the epic milieu. And the Book of Ether is an epic. It's an epic milieu. That's the surrounding, the setting that produces this type of literature. Ancient sources recall that after the waters of the flood have... Well, when I wrote this, I had no idea of the Book of Mormon in mind. Ether never occurred to me until after, double take. That after the waters of the flood have subsided, there came the great wind flood. See, there have been the three great floods, the flood of water, the flood of wind, and the last would be the flood of fire. And this was the great wind flood, which converted large areas of the world into sandy deserts. Halder considers the Sumerian version of the wind flood, he says, to be an excellent example of a text describing historical terms, events in terms of religious language. We get that in the Book of Ether, too. But these things, not only recorded, but they're recorded, of course, geologically. Historical reality is attested by wind-blown deposits of various widely separated periods. They're being studied by, especially by the Dutch everywhere, because Al Holland was one of those deposits, can be broadly correlated in some of the major migrations of people. Well, here, I have a very long footnote here with all sorts of references. The idea that the lace lands, all of Western China, is when the last ice thawed in the last ice age, you see the great winds blasted out from there, carrying this fine glacial dust. And that deposited as lace in China and in the eastern side in Hungarian basin and in Eastern Europe and in Western China, and you have these great deposits of lace, the dust being blown. But the thing is that we get a lot of this in, we certainly get it in Egypt. According to Samuel Noah Kramer is a Sumerologist. He went into the earliest Sumerian records that you can find, and he says, here we have a typical epic milieu. He says, the factors primarily responsible for the more characteristic features of the Greek, Indian, and Teutonic. See, you have this literature of the wandering people. Well, we mention it here. You find it among the Greeks, of course, epic literature. You find it in the Vedic literature in India, and you find it in the German literature, in the epics, in the sagas. And they've neglected it because nobody goes into Celtic very much, and the records aren't so full. There's lots of Old Norse and Icelandic, as you know. But they all tell the same story, though they're at different times, thousands of years apart. They were the same characteristic features at work, he says, in the ancient Near East as a whole in the earliest recorded times. These factors are always accompanied and aggravated, if not caused, by violent and prolonged atmospheric disturbances, he says. Wherever we return, the earliest records of the race offer a surprisingly uniform portrait of the wandering, storm-driven hero. And of course, we'd naturally include Jared and the brother of Jared. There's Horus and Enlil and Marduk and Mazda and Zeus and Teshub and Celtic Mercury or the Norse Odin, to name but a few, mounted on his thunder wagon, leading his toiling hosts across the windy steppes while the earth trembles and the sky gives forth with appalling electrical displays. Lots and lots and lots of references here. If you want me to read them, I will. No point to that. But this is, you're getting a standard situation here. And somehow this is going to concern us. Now, the what is it that drives them, this hostile planet we're living on? Well, of course, we say the winds and so forth, 75 and 80. And here we get it very clearly stated in the Book of Ether. The Burans of Asia, they're called Burans, are terrible at all times. Ancient and modern travelers tell almost unbelievable but uniform tales of those appalling winds that almost daily shift masses of sand, dust, and even gravel from one part of the continent to the other. Of course, nobody goes out at 4 o'clock in the summertime in Egypt because the violent, the Khamsin is going to begin now. The Khamsin, the 50-day wind that blows the sand and the gravel. That's why there's no heavy sand left in there. You walk on a crust of very coarse sand because all the fine stuff has been blown by thousands of years and it's exposed to all the stuff lying around. And the Egyptian record has a lot to say about it, of course. The almost daily shift masses, even gravel from one part of the continent to another. The great lace deposit we mentioned on the eastern and western fringes of the vast area bear witness to even more dreadful dust storms, remember just after the flood, that accompanied the drying up of the land after the glacial epoch. But when the world's weather gets out of hand, as it has a number of times in the course of history, the blowing sands of Asia bring mighty empires to ruin, bury great cities almost overnight, and scatter the tribes in all directions to overrun and submerge the more favored civilizations of the East and West. It's a very interesting thing. All the diggings and all the works that have been piled up in the preceding years by the BYU, you couldn't find them anymore. They're completely covered under the sand, just like that. So these things just pass away. The weather of Asia is the central driving mechanism of world history. Huntington's famous study on that, where climate and civilization, that came out in the 30s, quite sensational, by Professor Huntington, showing that the driving clock of history is the climate. There are certain things you can't do when the weather misbehaves. It is only in recent years that men have begun to correlate the great migrations of history with their attendant wars and revolutions, those major weather crises such as the great wind and drought of 2300, 2200 BC, the terrible droughts of 1700 BC, the world floods of 1300 BC, the great drought of 1000 BC, or the fimble winter of 850 BC, or the great, the terrible winter of 1600, time of Elizabeth, when The Thames seems to have frozen right to the bottom and so forth, reading Virginia Woolf's book on it. And so hypnotized, if students decide to become by the ease and directness of Victorian evolution as a slow, gradual thing. You have to realize, if this is violently interrupted from time to time, how can you have that long, steady, undisturbed growth taking place only in the jungles where conditions, we're told, haven't changed for millions of years, but have they? I mean, a particular frog that can only live in the water deposit on a large leaf, you see. Couldn't there have been a dry year? How many dry years would it take to make him extinct? Something's going on here anyway. Well, the Arl Stein in his book Lulan, we have it here, two massive works by Sir Arl Stein, who in Innermost Asia, he was the first to enter Lulan and the Lop-Nor Basin. He has described the deserted houses and streets of that city standing exactly as they did 14 centuries ago, when their inhabitants were driven forth by droughts so sudden and severe, neither the wood of the fruit trees nor the most delicate fabrics have rotted since. And I say that also applies with Egypt. You dig enough, everything is just the way it was. The mighty city of Etsina was suddenly deserted 600 years ago and not found until 1909. As all life died, the trees of the forest threw themselves to the ground. The storms arose, which soon buried the country in sand. To this day, the trees remain undecayed like sun-dried mummies, dead, naked, and gray over a vast area, once shady forest. They lay in thousands. We passed other ruins of deserted strongholds, a strange sensation. We dug up objects that no human being have touched for more than 600. Well, there are times when this hay fever. There are times when Nordenskjöld and others, when you can walk across the surface and you find where a camel has passed 1,400 years before, and there was one case in Lop-Nor where a bag of gold had broken and the coins were deposited all along. The driver was not aware of it, and they were covered up by the wind. They've been uncovered now, and there they are in a nice bright line for a mile or two, where all these bright gold coins, all you have to do is pick them up. Once we came upon an abandoned Sart village where newly thrown up dams and uncompleted excavations bore witness to the departed population's desperate struggle to retain the vanishing water. But a day had come when there was no more water to be had. You know, it's suggested quite seriously now that we turn the large parts of the Middle West back to grasslands. That animals stood by the watering places and sought in vain for moisture. The women wept in the houses, the men gathered the mosque to pray to Allah for miracles, but alone would save their home. But no miracle happened. The village got no water. The last extremity of famine, the people had thrown their most indispensable possessions on the remaining horses and donkeys and hastily left their homes and lands of their fathers to follow their Aksal, that's their village elder, the brother of Jared, you see, out into the parched country around in desperate search for water. Well, they still do that in Africa, you see. Large numbers of the population have simply piled up, left their villages forever in Ethiopia and gone on to those assembly centers. It's made worse by war, you see, where they might get something to eat, that's all, just to stay alive at all. And hundreds of thousands of Ethiopians have had to do that in our own time. And so he gives various examples. Now, there's the Etruscans did the same thing, the great epic of the Beni Hilal. I have a copy of it here. Remember Abraham, the famine waxed sore in the land throughout all Abraham's land. There was corn in Egypt, and that was the only place where there was corn, so everybody went to Egypt. But just as suddenly, calamity overtook an Asian village in 1927, we're told, when the storm itself laid itself to rest, the flying sand solidified again, and the terrified nomads found the whole face of nature changed into new shapes. And of course, Babylon, the city of the tower, has left behind the richest deposits of legend and tradition. And I give various examples here where, in the Sibylline books, in the Chronicle, in Eusebius Chronicle, when all men were of one tongue, some of them built a high tower so as to mount to heaven, but God destroyed the tower by mighty winds. But when the threats of the great God were fulfilled, of which he had warned mortal men at that time, they built a tower in the Assyrian land. They all at once spoke the same language and wanted to mount up to the starry heavens, but forthwith the immortal one laid great stress on the blasts, so that the wind overthrew the mighty tower and drove mortals to strive with one another. And when the tower had fallen, the languages of men were divided into many dialects for the same reason. You form dialects when people come together and when people separate. Both those effects are what changed language, of course. You get new language when people come together. You get new language when people separate. Both happened at the tower. And the book of Jubilees. The Lord sent a mighty wind against the tower and overthrew it upon the earth. And behold, it was between Asher and Babel in the land of Shinar, and they called its name Overthrow. My favorite source, the zealous learned Persian, Thalaby, records that when the people were scattered from the tower by an awful drought, accompanied by winds of such velocity as actually blew down the tower. And 40 years after the tower had finished, as Barhabraeus, who was the great collector of Central Asiatic lore from the Middle Ages, he says, God sent a wind and the tower was overturned and Nimrod died in it. And so we go on. And there's no reason for doubting that a great city called Babel once long ago suffered the same fate as the people of Ad and Thamud and Lulan and Etzingol and the Nasamonians and others. And so we have in the history of the Jaredites a very freakish state of things. The Lord commanded Nephi to build a ship, you know, but it was an ordinary ship. Levi's people had to try cross water at least twice as much, probably three or four times as much as the Jaredites. They took the short North Pacific route. But the Jaredite ships were altogether unusual vessels. The Lord gave the builder special instructions for every detail. They had to be submersible, yet ride very lightly on the surface of the wave. They were small, and they were light upon the water, we're told. Yet built to stand terrific pressure, exceedingly tight, tight like unto a dish, with special sealed vent holes that could not be opened when the water pressure on the outside was greater than the air pressure within. The Lord explained that it would be necessary to build such peculiar vessels because he was about to loose winds of incredible violence that would make the crossing a frightful ordeal at best. Any windows, he warned, would be dashed to pieces. Fire will be out of the question. You shall be as a whale in the midst of the sea, for the mountain waves shall dash upon you. You cannot cross the great deep, save I prepare for you against the waves of the sea, the winds which have gone forth, the floods which shall come. Therefore, what will ye that I should prepare for you that you may have light when you're swallowed up in the depth of the sea? See, the book of Ether enters right into the scene. This is exactly the situation we find. This violence and so forth, and the Lord talking. You say, well, how could they endure? 300 says, the wind in the Ether 6 and 8, the wind did never cease to blow toward the promised land while they were upon the waters for 344 days, these violent winds. Quote, the Lord God caused that there should be furious wind blow upon the face of the waters, and they were many times, this is 5 and 6, were many times buried in the depths of the sea because of the mountain waves which broke upon them, and also the great and terrible tempests which were caused by the fierceness of the wind. Well, you see the violence of the elements at the end of the last ice age. That's one of the remarkable discoveries about the ice age, you know. Not only there were a number, but how quickly they ended. Almost overnight they were over, but with great violence. And this is what you have here. And so we have windstorms in 2200 and 1000, I say, the great thimble winter and so forth. We have Kazwimi's account of the Great Dome of Baghdad. Now, this is an interesting thing, the Great Dome of Baghdad. This was in the Middle Ages, which was, he says, the symbol, the Alam of Baghdad, and the crown of the country, the principal achievement of the sons of Abbas, the Abbasids, and yet it collapsed during a great windstorm. The interesting thing is that from that tower, from that dome, that was the Green Dome, the Khadr, the Kubal Khadr, and from that dome, people wanted to reach heaven. They wanted to fly to heaven all through the Middle Ages. If you wanted to go to heaven and be blessed, you took off from the top of the Green Dome. Well, see, that's what they wanted the Tower of Babel, to get to heaven. The same thing. But here's thousands of years later in the Middle Ages doing the same thing and blown down by the wind, in spite of its massive build and so forth. Well, this is a significant thing there, this setting we're going to get here. And so this gives us, I say, what we call the heroic age. And what type of world is the heroic age here? Is this 292? It is. Yeah. Kramer says, heroic, it is contained, what is the new evidence for heroic ages and what characterizes them? Kramer says it's contained in the fragments of 9 epic poems for the Sumerians and shows that in their early history, says, the Sumerians passed through a cultural stage now commonly known as the heroic age. You notice everything about the Book of Ether is the heroic age. It starts out with a superhero, the brother of Jared, but the hero is never the leader. He always is the brother of the leader. It's a very interesting thing. They fall into this pattern. The secondary hero, a relative, and he does the glorious things, but he's not the king or the leader. He's rather a colorless character. Who is he? What did he do? Ah, but the brother of Jared, but the brother of Jared, we know all about him. Well, he says, once the existence of a Sumerian heroic age had been determined, it was possible to adduce its cultural pattern and historical background on analogy with such long-known heroic ages as those of Greek, Indian, and Teutonic peoples. He says he feels that the reality of the epic milieu actually permitted a reinterpretation of the earliest history of Mesopotamia, which may prove closer to the truth than those suggested hitherto. And of course, in Egypt, even more so. They're all the followers of Horus. They come in the Horus Way, the way of Horus from the northeast. And they and the civilization emerges overnight. There's no primitive background to Egyptian civilization. So what goes on here? He says, to begin with, what are the characteristics? We can go through and list some of the stock characters of heroic ages here. First of all, to begin with, says, this is Chadwick here. He said, picking out the most conspicuously marked passage here, the heroic age coincides with a period of upheaval. Well, that should be clear by now, and certainly clear from the Book of Enoch. They have to leave. They don't want to leave. He says, if we must leave, we go. And then we get this violent weather. A period generally known as the age of, a bad translation, you have to, you don't, can't do any better, the national migrations, the Völkerwanderung, the swarming time it's called. There are times when all the people in the world are in motion. This has happened. Boy, you should stand at crossroads in Central Europe, as I used to have to stand to check people that were passing. After the war, you'd find everybody passing. All the people that had been uprooted, you know, taken into Nazi German, Russian girls to work their poles. Everybody was scattered. Everybody was going home, pushing baby buggies, carrying things on their back, hauling wagons and so forth, and speaking every language you can imagine. We had lots of people as Azerbaijanians and so forth, because the coastal troops of the Germans were people from Central Asia who had been put there, who had actually been chained with chains to their positions, and they didn't know where they were. Most of them, some of them thought they were in America, and some of them thought they were in Africa. They didn't know where they were. But the world was all mixed up, and it could certainly happen again, couldn't it, the way things are. But he says here, the heroic age coincides with a period of upheaval generally known as national migrations, as swarming time. Well, better than, they keep calling it here, the time that produces it, the background that produces the epic milieu, is the heroic age. Is the heroic age, and that's what we're dealing with here. Because it has heroic dimensions, it's tragic, it's gloomy, people live terrible, it's an awful time. Remember what Goethe says about the Iliad, about Homer. He says, the Iliad proves to us that life on this earth is a hell. And it is. There's nothing happy about the heroic age, believe me. And then Kramer says, the factors primarily responsible for the more characteristic features of the heroic age are two. In the first place, heroic ages coincide with a period of national migrations of Völkerwanderungszeit, a wandering of the people. See, everybody is wandering now. Secondly, and this is by far more significant, these people had come in contact with civilized power in the process of disintegration. World civilization is collapsing, and that's why they have to move, and everybody has to move. Reports come from all sides on this. The victims, we have the epic literature of the heroic age, is described from two sides. We have a very large literature by the heroes themselves, describing their heroic deeds of their leaders and so forth. They're traditional, they're handed down by bards, they're sung for thousands of years. And the other is the victims, and that's the great lamentation literature. We have a very rich, the earliest literature we have from Sumer, from Mesopotamia and Egypt, is the lamentation literature. A man's conversation with his soul and the one that the gardener edited. And there are others. So the reports come from both sides. The victims describe in chronicles of woe how the barbarians move in on them, while the invaders glorify the same exploits in epic song. Real epic poetry always describes conditions prevailing in times of world upheaval, evil, and mass migration. And now, the feeling, this is another point. That's Chadwick's first point, actually. The second point with Chadwick is, quote, feeling for nationality is of no account in the heroic. Everything centers around a great heroic figure, as it does throughout the Book of Ether, you know. You draw people off to your side, and we see about that. Feeling for nationality is of no account in heroic poetry or saga. Love of home and duty of defending it are, of course, recognized, but interest is always concentrated on the doings or experiences of individuals. And this is the way Kramer describes the situation, Samuel Noah Kramer. Now, the most characteristic features of all four of our heroic ages is this. They represent a rather barbarous cultural stage in the life of people, which has come far indeed from primitive, but has yet attained the maturity and stability of a civilized people. Its dominant element is rather a numerous military class, and of course, all they do throughout the Book of Eager is fight, to whom the underlying bulk of the population counts for very little. These kingly aristocrats, who have freed themselves from tribal obligations and ideas which govern the more primitive people, at the same time, they have developed no true national organization, are inspired by little, if any, national feeling. They're led by the hero, you see. Their success and failure depend on personal prowess, their leaders, and kings whom they follow, but from whom they are ready to drift away if these tend to turn too peaceful or become ungenerous in their rewards, or especially if they get beaten. Then you belong to the other person, as it's set forth very clearly in the Book of Ether. In every case, something forced them to move when these people are on the move. They certainly did the Jaredites. If they come to the stage rather shabbily equipped, it's not because they began life that way, but because something happened that made them pull up stakes in a hurry and clear out with just enough stuff for a forced march. You have to leave behind what you had. That's too bad. You have to junk it. And you see, that's going to happen. Remember, these people are not habitual nomads. They're moving because they have to. Remember the brother of Jared, please ask the Lord not to make us move if we don't have to. And if we have to, then he says, give us a promised land and see to it that we will not be confounded. See, when people are confounded, that's when the language is confounded. But he says the people are confounded here, and that's what makes it happen. In every case, they're looking for lands to settle in. Yesterday, they had on the, from Switzerland, they had an international council going on, Council of Nations going on there, very important sort of thing. They had a desk where they were translating the language being spoken in the meeting, 19 translators. They were speaking 19 different languages at this meeting, you see. And if these people are now having to work together for the first time, all of them, much more closely, the language is developed only because they lived in isolation and were closely knit cultural among themselves. And now, of course, Lithuanian is, notice, the oldest language in the world. It is the primal, original Indo-European language. That is as near as you can get to it. That's in theory. You see, if you work back to all the stems and the forms and so forth, Lithuanian is older than Sanskrit, older than any language we have, or Greek or anything like that. Those languages are old, and yet it seems that Lithuanian maintains, so it shows what a long time they've maintained their integrity as people, an astonishing thing. And so, they have to, it's just like the Tower of Babel, isn't it? We've got to have some common language, but now we have some gadgets to do those things. It could be like some of these space thrillers on the TV where everybody knows English. No matter where you go in the universe, they all speak the same language. So they're not habitual nomads. They're forced because they have to. In every case, they're looking for lands to settle in, always looking for the promised land. The marvelous poems of the first Greek, well, for that matter, Hesiod talks about that. Or Alcman, we didn't come here of our choice to the wind. Well, he says we came to Rindy Erinus because we were driven to do so. And Hesiod, who is contemporary of Homer, he writes about it. He says, we came to this land, he says, because we were driven, because we had to. We didn't take it because seeking riches at all. We didn't because we lost everything we had, and we had to come. And so we came to Iskra, he says, where we live now. He says, a bad place in winter, a vile place in summer, a good time never. They had to settle, they had no choice, he says. And their life has been very hard since. That's why he writes a poem called Works and Days to his brother. He says, his brother had gone up and made a lot of money in the market. He says, there's no character and there's no stability in that. He says, the only thing is to work. And he follows the catalog of the work of the farmer. It's the almanac, the farmer's almanac that he writes, telling his brother how he should. Well, that's a typical example. They were forced to move and they settled where they could and so forth. And Alpin tells the same story, how they came down to Sparta the same way, from windy Uranus. It mentions the wind. And so, now it's granted that these people, wherever they go, find civilization in the process of disintegration, that's quoting him. Wherever they go, they find civilization, but everything is disintegrated wherever they go, so it's easy to overrun, or is it? It's a time of world calamity. What reason have we, therefore, to doubt that it was the disintegration of their own less stable civilization that forced them to move in the first place? If they move in on the world and collapse, you can be perfectly sure they left one behind as well. Otherwise, they would never have migrated. And the evidence? Well, the mere fact that our heroes do not enjoy what they are doing. They want to get the business over and settle down as soon as possible. Get some examples here. The heroic mood, quoting E.V. Gordon, who writes a classic work on the Norse sagas, as our Norse ancestors. See, they came, the word North Norway means Norðurvegur, by the North Way. They came to the Baltic by the North Way. And, but the East is the Östurvegur, and there's the West Way, the North Way, but their people came and settled were the people that came via the Norðurvegur, and they came from Central Asia back there, and so their home is still Norway. But E.V. Gordon says, a good resistance against overpowering odds was made the characteristic situation of heroic literature. The gods themselves knew that they would in the end be overwhelmed by evil powers. Now, this is a gloomy note, you see. But they were prepared to resist to the last. Every religious-minded man of the heathen age believed that he existed for the sake of that hopeless cause. It's not a very cheery sort of thing. The third point that Chadwick makes is, epic is concerned not only with individuals, but primarily with individuals who are princes. The cast of characters, we are told, quoting here, consists almost wholly of princes and their military followers, as the Book of Ether does. Among these, there is usually one character whose adventures form the chief subject of interest. Another score, you see. He's always immortal and human, and he always occupies a position of subordination. It's an interesting thing here, because that's exactly what the brother of Jared does. He's not the leader, but he's the only one to hear about. Taking orders from a relatively colorless king or commander. Remember, it's Jared who says to his brother, go and ask the Lord whether we'll have to move or not. But it's the brother of Jared who asks him, but his brother commands him to, well, why is it called the Book of Ether, named after the brother instead of the brother of Jared? Henry Moriankum, or whatever it was. Well, because he was the first in the line, in the patriarchal line. He was the oldest. That's why the book's named after him, and the people are the people of Ether. But it's the other one who is the hero, takes orders from a relatively colorless king or commander. He is almost superhuman, but never supernatural. Again, his strength. And yet, from time to time, he receives supernatural aid. Altogether a strange and impressive figure. It's rather remarkable that the only really heroic figure in the Book of Mormon are found in Ether. Lehi, Nephi, King Benjamin, King Noah, and so forth are certainly great men, but they're not outsized the way the heroes are in the Book of Ether. Chadwick notes that even though the most ferocious, now this is an interesting thing too that's characteristic of the Book of Ether. We're quoting here, even though the most ferocious and even depraved characters occupy the stage of epic, there is no character who appears uniformly in an unfavorable light. They're all human beings and their weaknesses are all recognized, but they're not, nobody is completely vicious as we like to imagine our enemies, totally depraved. We're the totally good, they are the totally bad. There's none of that in it, because after all, they have a common experience. Remember, you were once, another famous one who was driven out, who was, Dido, Queen Dido and her sister Melissa, they left Phoenicia around 800 BC and settled Carthage. And when Aeneas comes to visit them in Carthage, and she says, non ignaris mali, non ignara mali miseris securur disco. We've had our hard times and we know how to be good to wandering people because we know what you suffered. He said, we're all in this sort of thing together, so we have to be more or less charitable with each other. That's why the Arabs, who are so ferocious and bloodthirsty at the drop of a hat, nevertheless have the strictest laws of hospitality, because they know what it is to be lost in the desert. They know what it is to depend for your life on somebody else's hospitality. So Abraham was, first of all of his virtues was hospitality. He was the friend of man, which made him the friend of God, we're told. So these people know how to get along with each other, because they're all in the swim together. They're all moving around together. And at times when you feel that you don't feel superior because you're taking an awful beating yourself. So he says here, you will find that also true, well, we find it also true of the Jaredite monsters. You can't feel, well, there's a touch of admiration, even sympathy for Shiz and Coriantumr, these heroes in the Book of Mormon, and the licentious tyrants like Noah and Rip Lakish. They're not only real patrons of the arts, they have a real touch of real magnificence. Chadwick rings the bell here. He says, the behavior of the heroes often strikes their reader as childish or brutal. But their dealings with one another have a dignified and fastidious tone prevails even between bitter rivals, that is. And all throughout the Book of Ether, you know, you challenge a person to a duel. He doesn't have to have the duel. But the story of Ether is one continual series of duels, as you know. But they're on this chivalric level, actually chivalry, the people wandering around with their horses. And so they put up with each other. He says, Chadwick says, warfare is an essential rather than an accessory of heroic life. That leads to our next point, that the scene of action in epics is confined exclusive to the battlefield, the court, the hunt, or some place of adventure, usually a wilderness. And then, of course, when you say wilderness, that puts you in mind of Ether, and that's fair game, too. But the in this rough society, the cardinal virtues of a hero are courage, loyalty, and generosity, of course. The courage is strictly physical, bravery in the field. Loyalty is purely personal, as long as the person can hold it. It involves duty of vengeance as well as protection. As to generosity, it's always a matter of policy. The generosity of a chief to his followers, a princely bribe with admitted intent to buy and support supporters by gifts. Remember how Beowulf begins. Oftskilskifing, he gave out his gold rings to his faithful followers, and it says, that was good king. That was a good king. You can hold them, because that's why you're running your raid. You're running your raid to get the junk to pay the people. Well, let's give some examples here, some modern examples. There's a very good one. Well, here, what Chadwick says, I'll quote this one from it because it's so close to our Ether book. Plunder is a necessity for the hero who wishes to maintain an active force of armed followers. Plundering raids appear to be a characteristic feature of the heroic age everywhere. Indeed, we may say an essential feature. The booty derived therefrom enabled active and ambitious princes to attract to themselves and maintain large bodies of followers without which they were at mercy of their neighbors. Then, and so we have something on this here. And then we have, which is very rich in the Ether story. Well, characteristics. Now, why is this for us? Before I go on with this other stuff, why does this apply to us? Well, look at our Book of Ether here now, beginning. It starts out, and he starts out with that negative tone. Notice the first book, the first verse. You better have your book some more because we're on Ether now. We have a very convenient book here to go by, a handbook. And Moroni, he's giving the account of this, the inhabitants who were destroyed upon the face of this north country. See, they make the north crossing. They belong in the north country. And he took them from the 24 plates of the Book of Ether. Now, the first part of the record he's leaving out, that's biblical. The part I give is from the tower down to the time they were destroyed. Then he gives this long genealogy, but notice occasionally he says, as in verse 16 and 23, and Aaron was a descendant of Heth, who was the son of Herthan. Descendants, you could introduce 20 generations between if you wanted to. Then you come down to the 23rd, and Morianton was a descendant of Riplakish. Riplakish, there's a good archaic name, Lord of Lakish. There are at least five ancient cities, the oldest cities. In fact, the oldest city in Mesopotamia is supposed to have been called Lachish. And this is Riplachish, which means Lord of Lachish, Rab Lachish, is it? And so here, but he was a descendant of Riplachish. So let's not worry about chronology here. It goes way back, I can tell you that. But the Lord swore in his wrath. Now we're getting this grim, heroic situation. The Lord swore in his wrath that they should be scattered upon all the face of the earth. Sounds like the Nibelungen read, doesn't it? And the brother of Jared, being a large and mighty man, notice it's the brother of Jared, he's going to be the hero now. The large and mighty man, man highly favored of the Lord. Jared, his brother, said unto him, cry unto the Lord. See, he has to ask his brother to do it, but it's by matter of command. He's the one who gives orders here. Said, cry unto the Lord that he will not confound us, notice. Our words will only be confounded if we're confounded. That means confound means to mix up together, confundere, mix together like that. And if we get mixed together with other people, of course they're speaking different dialects, different language, and we'll have an awful time trying to understand each other. It's very much like the ward in Cairo, where we have a dozen African languages there, and some of them speak nothing else. And we have services in Arabic and everything. And we're confounded, we're mixed up, we have an awful time understanding each other. That's what they're talking about here, what happened to the tower, when people are forced to move. Cry again to the Lord. Now notice, this is going to be a large migration, and this, he's going to get a company. It's not like Lehi, it's a family job. This is something else, notice. He cried unto the Lord and said, compassion upon their friends and their families also, and they were not confounded. It's going to be a large group that moves out. Go and inquire of the Lord whether he will drive us out of the land and whither we shall go if he does. We're down in the 38th verse here, yes. And so it goes on. And who knoweth but the Lord will carry us to a choice land above all other lands. Of course, that's the way Achan begins. We have been driven to, when they looked for a promised land, they didn't very often find it. That's when they wanted. Oh, Aeneas says that. Remember, he visits the queen in Carthage and he says, Tendibus in Zadio, per varius casus per tot discriminarum, tender in latium, don't let satis quietis, so forth. Per varius, through various violent experience, through rough, clashes and wars, struggles against nation, per various casus, per tot discriminaris, so many showdowns and fights, we are looking for a place where we can find quietus, sedes quietus, a quiet place to settle, and which is, of course, to become glorious Rome, whose terminat astres, imperioque no, Famamque terminat astris, whose empire will terminate only with the bounds of the ocean and whose glory shall reach beyond the stars. See, but this promised land theme, they all have this promised land throughout the ancient, because if you were wandering and you were cast out, you want to go to a better land, you want a good one. And you say, for heaven's sake, when can we settle? When will we be in Zion? When will we reach there? And so this happens again. They're doing it all the time. Will it be for a land choice above all the others? And the Lord heard his brother, and this is what he says, go together, flocks. Notice, they move on a vast front. Now we have from the 13th century BC, marvelous accounts of the coming of the people of the sea along the north coast of Africa and along the coast of Europe. They came from the west, and because the climate drove them, and we have pictures of them. Their ships follow along by sea, and they follow along by land, and they go, they clear up into Palestine. They were beaten by Meriptah in a battle at the Delta, so they couldn't settle in Egypt. But they come by the thousands with these huge ox carts loaded along with their families and all the goods they own, and they lumber along the coast while the ships are coming to them. That's the way the Vikings used to do too. Thousands of years later, our own ancestors did the same thing. And they got down and they settled clear down in Luna, they settled in Italy, and they got to Palestine. It's funny that these things go on. We seem to, you say, this is where I came in. This is the same old story again. Well, this is a part of history, you see, we can't afford to ignore. And so he goes on in this first chapter. Gather together flocks of every kind, male and female, seed of thy families, and thy friends and their families. Get everybody together you can, to all families. See, this is going to be a big crowd. And their families, and Jared and their families. And go down into the valley northward. They go northward, and then it says, where there never had man been. I see... I'm leaving out all sorts of things down here. There I'm going to go, and I will meet thee, and I will raise up thee a great nation, and there shall be none greater. This is what they want. So they went down into the valley northward, which was the valley of Nimrod. It's very interesting, the north end of Mesopotamia. All the places bear the name Nimrod. There's Bir Nimrod, and Nimrod names dozens of them up. Northern Mesopotamia, where you go through, and then you go east, and what do? You cross many waters. They did lay snares for the fowls of the air, and they had vessels in which they took fish. Well, we give examples of these things. And they took Deseret, which is the honeybee. We mentioned the fact that Deseret is the mystic secret name given to the honeybee by the Egyptians, too. Because the Egyptians were moving in the same direction. They moved with the honeybee. He was their leader when they moved in the other direction. They moved toward the southwest, and these people moved toward the northeast in opposite directions. Remember, it was the daughter of a descendant of Noah, Aegyptus, who led her people into Egypt and settled there in the opposite direction. This time in Deseret was their beacon, their sign. And you can see the family about ready to depart, packed all the baggage and everything, all these people, somebody running around among the wagons saying, what happened to little Deseret? Where's Deseret? Deseret always gets lost, you know, when they're going to go. But knows it means hives of bees. And they do take hives of bees with them. It's a very interesting thing. Remember, there were no hive bees in the New World. There were no bees in Mesopotamia until quite late. The bees are first found in Palestine and Egypt. They're not spread around universally, as you might think. In the Chilambalam, you find them in the New World, but when they were brought here. It's very interesting, the distribution of bees. There's been a good deal written about that. But anyway, the Lord talked with the brother Jared, and they went forth into the wilderness, into that quarter where there never had man been. Well, you get the idea that there's quite a world population at this time. But they went into virgin territory where there had never been any, and they traveled. As they traveled in the wilderness, they built barges, shallow barges. Now, a very recent National Geographic, which I would have brought along, shows the shrinking of the Great Aral Sea in Central Asia. It's just east of the Caspian. You know, the Caspian is actually shrinking to nothing, but that's a huge sea. These huge shallow seas, and then you go further west, and there are many seas. All of Western Asia was drying out at this time. In 1906, Raphael Pompelli, we have his vast work published by the Smithsonian here, made an exploration of those Central Asiatic regions, and it was all shallow water. It was all underwater. Well, they still tell you. I think you can see documentaries, about a wandering lake in Central Asia. Because of the winds, the lake actually wanders around. It's so shallow, it was full of shallow water, and in the time of the Jaredites, just after the flood, these spirits would be much deeper. But they build these drafts of barges of shallow draft because they have to cross a lot of water on their passing. And then when they get to the ocean, they have to build a different type of boat entirely. But all these things are geographically correct, I mean, he's talking about. Yeah, you get Pompelli's book, you might put it on. Oh, I was going to tell you what subject we're going to write about, but... Raphael Pompelli, yeah. Yes, these things are really quite remarkable, what Joseph has given us here, you know. The Lord talked to him, they built their many barges. But you notice, he would not suffer that they should stop beyond BC in the wilderness. They had to cross the Caspian, which was a vast sea at that time, twice as large. At least 2,000 miles long, you see. It was a huge. And after they'd crossed it, he said they had to keep going. They hadn't arrived yet. So that's the picture we get. Here we have more of these if you want them. I say, they'll save you a lot of note-taking.